Situated at Denver International's south entrance is a dedication plaque dated March 19, 1994. The plaque, or capstone, as it is referred to, rests on the floor of the airport without much elaboration. The carved granite and stainless steel stone is relatively unassuming. If you are rushing to catch public transit or navigate yourself to a hotel, there's a good chance you'd hurry right past it. For those travelers who perhaps slow down and take a moment to glance at the inscription, upon casual browsing, it reads much like any small monument of people's pride and labor, commemorating the airport's conception and construction, and thanking those who made it possible. But if you set your luggage down and really focus on the capstone, there's a story there, carved into its granite face. And while most of us would read it and just see a passing gratitude to those people who made the airport possible, there's others that take away a very different tale. One not about the celebration of the airport's final fruition, but about our humanity's end. Depending on who you talk to, this lone, unassuming piece of granite resting in the airport's southern entrance has a very different meaning. But what is it really trying to tell us? Thank you for listening to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. On this episode, how does an airport make conspiracy theories take flight?
The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. H.P. Lovecraft, 1927.
At the core of any conspiracy theory is the awareness that something is being hidden from us. It is one of the absolute only certainties in conspiracies. Normal perceptions or explanations do not make up the full picture. The true hidden purpose or the unknown lies hidden beyond normal conventional understanding. This absence, this void, can fill anyone with a sense of unease. It's the unfamiliar. Fear of the unknown has long been a subject of debate for endless amounts of academics, neuroscientists, authors, even statisticians. Fear of the unknown is at the root of our own primitive fight or flight response. Fear of the unknown does not require any type of prior learning. The first thing that could be feared is what author Nicholas Carlson calls the perceived absence of information at any level of consciousness. All other fears appear to require some perceived presence or recalled information. After all, to have this base chemical reaction of fight or flight, our minds have to make the jump to recognize and react that something is a threat. That moment of our fear becoming tangible, identifiable, is the impetus humans need to act. It's our survival instinct. So it's of no wonder not being able to recognize what scares us is so unnerving. Our brain can't process any data to formulate how to manage the threat. It just knows that there is one. Freud, who wrote a lot about fear, called this
a condition of free-floating fear, as it were, which is ready to attach itself to any appropriate idea, to influence judgment, to give rise to expectation, in fact, to seize any opportunity to make itself felt. We call this condition expectant fear or anxious expectation. Persons who suffer from this sort of fear always prophesy the most terrible of all possibilities, interpret every coincidence as an evil omen, and ascribe to the dreadful meaning of all uncertainty.
Freud's description of this free-floating fear and those who suffer from it definitely sound like qualities we would describe conspiracy theorists of having. Uncertainty is dangerous, and all outcomes are predetermined, but not to our benefit. The most terrible of all possibilities and the interpretation of every coincidence is evil, and it does describe the mindset where conspiracies bear the most fruit. Authors Karen M. Douglas, Robbie M. Sutton, and Alexandra Chikakra write in The Psychology of Conspiracy Theories, causal explanations serve the need for people to feel safe and secure in their environment and to exert control over their environment as autonomous individuals and as members of collectives. In short, people want to feel safe or feel as if we have control over what's happening in our lives. We take security in what is known. The psychology of conspiracy theories continues. Several early theories of conspiracy belief suggest that people turn to conspiracy theories for compensatory satisfaction when their needs are threatened. And other research indicates that conspiracy belief is strongly related to the lack of socio-political control or the lack of psychological empowerment. For example, people who feel like they don't have control may be afforded some sense of control by conspiracy theories, just because they offer them the opportunity to reject official narratives and feel like they possess an alternative account. They may promise to make people feel safer, and scenarios where dangerous and untrustworthy individuals are recognized and the threat they posed is reduced or neutralized. Author Michael Barkin assigns three rules to conspiracy theories.
1. Nothing happens by accident. Conspiracy implies a world based on intentionality, from which accident and coincidence have been removed. Anything that happens occurs because it has been willed. 2. Nothing is as it seems. Appearances are deceptive because conspirators wish to deceive in order to disguise their identities or their activities. Thus, the appearance of innocence is deemed to be no guarantee that an individual or group is benign. 3. Everything is connected. Because the conspiracist world has no room for accident, pattern is believed to be everywhere, albeit hidden from plain view. Hence, the conspiracy theorist must engage in a constant process of linkage and correlation in order to map the hidden connection.
So not only do conspiracy theories give people a sense of control, they also rationalize and simplify down complex, harder-to-understand ideas. The conspiracy theory takes the unknown, that thing that is so vast and terrifying, and gives it a shape that we can manage. It takes something that we don't have a language for to describe and gives it a more simple narrative. Author Michael Barkin continues.
In an odd way, the conspiracy theorist view is both frightening and reassuring. It is frightening because it magnifies the power of evil, leading, in some cases, to an outright dualism in which light and darkness struggle for cosmic supremacy. At the same time, however, it is reassuring, for it promises a world that is meaningful rather than arbitrary. Not only are events non-random, but the clear identification of evil gives the conspiracist a definable enemy against which to struggle, endowing life with purpose.
But with all this, why an airport? How did one building become such a magnet for these types of thoughts? Besides lost luggage, what true evil could DIA embody to struggle against? There's one significant element inside of the airport that helps lay the groundwork for the conspiracy theory mindset. You could argue that there's more than that, but for the sake of all of our sanities, I'm going to focus on the capstone, time capsule, and the theories that have spun out from there. As I pointed out in episode 1 of this series, Denver International Airport was in every conceivable way a major undertaking. More than a commercial airport, it was one of Denver's major initiatives in the late 80s to revitalize the city's lagging economy and its future growth. And one man was the driving force for this change, Denver Mayor Frederico Peña. In 1983, when Peña decided to run for mayor, his opponent was longtime incumbent William H. McNichols, Jr. Mayor for 14 years, McNichols was the favored to win, but the voters instead chose Peña, the first Hispanic mayor of Denver. Peña was ambitious. He started on many new projects as mayor: the downtown library, a large convention center, a new baseball team for Denver, the Colorado Rockies, and Denver International Airport. The airport was never an easy sell, said Freud Cerulli, president of Cerulli Associates, a Denver-based public policy and government affairs consulting company. it may be the last airport of its size to be built from scratch in this country. The project was a highly political fight from the beginning. Selling the airport to the public was one thing. Winning federal government support and persuading the skeptical airline industry was another. Peña needed financial backing on his side to make Denver International happen. We'll go into where that financing for DIA came from in our next episode, because that's its own story. But for now, let's say it was very important to have people and financial institutions on Peña's side to get the airport built. The key is to educate the American people about how critical transportation infrastructure is to the economy, Peña said. We take transportation for granted until it doesn't work. Airports are the economic engines, and this was a strategic investment to diversify the economy and bring in jobs. Denver does not have a seaport, and for it to compete globally, we can only do so by air. The importance of financial backing for DIA is where the dedication marker comes into play. As mentioned in our opening, this plaque or capstone is about 3 feet wide, 4 feet long, and is made of granite. It is basically a flat slab of dull gray rock. The plaque itself lists government officials, mayors, the governor, and Peña himself, and says, "The time capsule beneath this stone contains messages and memorabilia to the people of Colorado in 2094. It also has the square and compass of the Freemasons, along with a listing of the two grand lodges of Freemasonry in Colorado that contributed to the airport. The date it was placed, March 19, 1994, under the date are more dedications, the first being to the New World Airport Commission." If the sealed time capsule and masonry references were not enough to ignite the imagination of a conspiratorial mindset, that last phrase is what starts the wildfire. And again, this one little piece of stone gives you a lot to unpack. For the sake of all of our sanities, let's focus on one thing: the New World Airport Commission. The strangest thing about this is that the New World Airport Commission doesn't currently exist. It's actually the New, World Airport Commission, according to the airport. It was designed by a planning and advocacy group consisting of local businesses and political leaders. Conspiracy theorists argue that the New World Airport Commission really refers to the New World Order. What's entailed in this singular phrase, the New World Order, is a pretty slippery thing. Major American historical events have a name associated to them. For example, the fall of the Berlin Wall, September 11th, Arab Spring. These events are so significant that we can distill them down to just the simplest of monikers. Or maybe it's our need to identify and name our shared experiences. But the result is the same. It's not just about a date or an event. It's a change in our cultural lexicon. When someone asks you where you were on September 11th, there's a very good chance you will automatically have the context that goes beyond just a date. So what then is the context behind New World Order? It actually has historical roots, but was never assigned to describe any one political movement or event. It almost sounds like a group of people or a nationality, but that is not defined. But somehow, this is the gold standard of conspiracies, against which everything else can be measured. Jesse Walker, author of The United States of Paranoia, says,
"The connection of all these dots together into a single overarching meta-conspiracy theory based on postmodern ideas that reality is an illusion. The reality we perceive is a hologram, and evil beings are manipulating that hologram to suit their sadistic agenda. In many ways, the ultimate conspiracy theory. If you buy into the premise that conspirators control our very perception of reality, it quickly becomes an inescapable intellectual black hole."
Or as journalist and professor Hua Su writes, that
"The New World Order is not so much a single plot as a way of reading history.
Any historical or cultural event can be reinterpreted through the dark lens of the New World Order. Its reach and permutation is everywhere, but impossible to distinguish. There's an overarching, very evil agenda, but there's only the most subtle clues as to what it really is." Professor Su continues,
at its most basic level, a cabal, working in secret as well as through official seeming above-ground means, seeks to establish an all-powerful, possibly Luciferian, one-world government. Suspicions surrounding a shadow establishment date back at least to the 1700s, with the birth of the Freemasons and the Illuminati. But it was the past century's global wars, political realignments, and media innovations that gave new purchase to this age-old paranoia. In the modern version, the New World Order hides in plain sight, a Mad Lib-style meta-story about how the free people of the West have begun to willingly, blindly surrender ourselves to our coming totalitarian overlords. What they want to do to us is never exactly clear. The anxiety tends to be more about the new part than the order part.
The idea of the New World Order did not always have troubling connotations to it. In the early 19th century, the New World Order was more defined in terms of global centrism, triggered by major events, namely wars. In April of 1917, as a reaction to World War I, American President Woodrow Wilson sought to create an internal order of nations to peacefully manage conflict. Called the League of Nations, its goal was to end senseless warfare. Wilson's lofty goal for the League of Nations was to ensure that their members would be politically independent and have their own territorial integrity, or that one nation state would not use force against another. These nations collectively would support each other's independence while strengthening their global positioning. By stipulating united action to blockade, impose trade boycotts, or even use military force. Today, the League of Nations is commonly viewed as a failure. It is, according to author Jesse Walker, where the term New World Order was introduced to the political and cultural lexicon to describe evolving world institutions. The New World Order was the subject of writer H.G. Wells' 1940 treatise, published 1 year after the outbreak of World War II. Wells advocated that together, nation-states could work to prevent future violence, working together towards peace. The historical idea of the New World Order was about attaining peace, and the clearest example of this would be the creation of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, especially an attractive idea as nations endured two world wars. NATO came about largely because of the perceived need to balance rising Soviet power in the aftermath of World War II. America and Europe agreed to a mutual defense pledge, but also in advocating democratic governance, the rule of law, civil and human rights, and an increasingly open international economy. In 2010, then-Secretary General of NATO, Anders Rasmussen, addressed the issues that NATO had faced in its past and addressed what it would face in the upcoming years.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, the Second World War finally brought home what the First World War should already have taught us. The security of Europe and North America is indivisible. The historical lesson is the reason why visionary politicians from both sides of the Atlantic created NATO in 1949. From now on, North America and Europe would organize their security together. The founding members of NATO considered an attack on one as an attack on all. This promise, enshrined in Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, is the strongest commitment that sovereign nations can make towards one another. And when the Cold War ended and the eastern half of Europe was finally able to make its own free choice as well, their choice was simple and clear. They too wanted to become part of this unique zone of stability, prosperity, and common values symbolized by NATO and the European Union. As a result, since the end of the Cold War, both institutions have doubled their membership. We have achieved more than the founding fathers of the transatlantic relationship dared to dream.
The goal of NATO isn't just about working towards peace. Equally important is achieving financial stability, growth, and prosperity. After two world wars and the Great Depression, international trade and finance had been in retreat for decades. NATO helped develop international trade policies between the five largest trading economies at the time, Britain, France, the Federal Republic of Germany, Japan, and the United States. Organized into a collective force, countries in NATO could arrange favorable trade policies to help strengthen their allies, or in turn isolate and weaken hostile countries. Currently, while political pundits debate the role of NATO in a post-Cold War world, there is no question the necessity of its origin and its lasting effects. This alliance is the basis for most other international institutions, including the United Nations and the World Bank. It is referred to as the most successful military alliance in history and proves to be the key instrument in defending its members against Soviet attack and ultimately speeding the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And even though it is a military alliance, for the last seven decades, NATO has invoked its Article 5 mutual defense commitment only once, in defense of the United States after the attacks of September 11th. And perhaps most recently, September 1990, President George H.W. Bush addressed a joint session of Congress to announce that the U.S. military and its alliances would go to war to evict Iraqi troops who had invaded Kuwait. But Bush said the mission had a greater objective, an establishment of what he called a new world order, in which nations of the world would live together in harmony.
And we stand today at a unique and extraordinary moment. The crisis in the Persian Gulf, as grave as it is, also offers a rare opportunity to move toward an historic period of cooperation. Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge, a new era, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace.
For the idea of the New World Order to shift from historically factual references into the meta-conspiracy is pretty straightforward. Massive global organizations making decisions on humanity's best interests could be a good thing. Working to promote peace, democracy, stability after military conflicts, or it could be the very opposite, based on your own ideologies about power. Professor Joseph Yuzinski says, ideology is a set of interrelated beliefs that provide a way for people to understand the world. Ideologies tell people what is important, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys, and what their goals are, and how should those goals be reached. Without ideologies to help categorize and interpret information, the world would be left meaningless. Some ideologies, such as left or right political ideologies, address the role of government in society and how to achieve proper order. Others might focus on economy or religion or race or something else. Conspiracy theories flourish when people feel anxiety, alienation, paranoia, a loss of control. Yuzinski writes, the personal ideology is just one marker that influences conspiracy. We should also take into consideration the amount of prejudice people harbor against powerful groups they find less likable, and the degree to which people view events and circumstances as the product of conspiracies. We call this widespread and stable belief system the conspiracy dimension, and have conceived of it along a continuum, ranging from the extremely naive, those believing conspiracies cause nearly nothing, to the extremely cynical, those believing that conspiracies cause nearly everything. For decades, conspiracy theorists have been warning about the New World Order. There were the critics of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and fears about the United Nations post-World War II. During the Cold War, there was the John Birch Society and their anti-communist paranoia. As the Cold War ended, Mary Davidson published The Profound Revolution, where the New World Order hides in plain sight and details how the Federal Reserve, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the U.S. government operate as fronts for the shadow establishment. The 1990s brought out Pat Robertson's book, The New World Order, where Freemasons, Wall Street, the Council on Foreign Relations, New Age mystics, all got combined into a New York Times bestseller. President Bill Clinton signs the Brady Handgun Violence Protection Act, gun control as the first step towards a one-world government, as seen with the incidents at Ruby Ridge and Waco, Texas. Later in the 90s, 2 years after the end of the Waco siege, Timothy McVeigh detonates a truck bomb outside of the Alfred F. Murray Federal Building in Oklahoma City, a building that McVeigh used to symbolize government overreach. 2001, radio host Alex Jones accuses the United States government of plotting terrorism and points to Osama bin Laden as the boogeyman they need in this Orwellian phony system. The symbolic weight of the New World Order is heavy and will have a gravitational effect on anything that sounds close to it, such as Denver International's New World Airport Commission. While it is reported that there was no such organization, there actually was. Its main function in the 1990s was to serve almost as the cultural event arm for the newly constructed airport, to plan events, to continue fundraising, to enlist Colorado's wealthy to support and be engaged. Remember, Mayor Frederico Peña needed this type of capital to support his plans for economic growth for Denver. The people with wealth require a certain amount of cultural enticement for their support and engagement. Galas, fundraising, charitable events, the effort to curry favor and fortify support for DIA was the responsibility of the New World Airport Commission. But the fact that it's no longer an organization is no deterrent to the conspiracy believer, only proof that the group is hidden from public. So who was in this shadowy commission memorized on the plaque, and how'd they get their nefarious moniker? Denver International Airport's media relations chief, Heath Montgomery, told Thrillist reporter Colin St. John.
The capstone was part of the pre-opening festivities. It's a time capsule that's sealed with two pieces of granite that the Masons made. Unfortunately, people connect the Freemasons with the Illuminati and secret societies and all of that stuff. We do have two Masonic symbols on here because the Masons actually made this for us. It's not uncommon to have the Masons to be a part of large public facility openings, like an airport. He continues, "The other thing that doesn't help us is that the inscription on the stone says, quote, New World Airport Commission, and people rightly say that that doesn't exist. Well, that's because it doesn't exist, but it did exist in 1994. It was a group that was celebrating the opening of the airport. It's written a little wonky. It's supposed to read, quote, the new, comma, World Airport Commission. It doesn't help because it says, quote, New World right there. Montgomery then points to a braille tablet that rises up from the stone and features one of the two Masonic symbols. My favorite conspiracy I ever heard of is, if you touch it the right way, it's a kind of keypad that's connected with aliens or the release of toxic gas, he says.
So who were the illustrious members of the New World Airport Commission? In my research, I found two worthy of note. The most prominent figure is their chair, Charles Ansbacher, a longtime art advocate. In 2007, 3 years before his death, Charles Ansbacher attempted to explain the commission's moniker in an interview with local alt-weekly paper Westward. In 1990, he was living in Denver and working as a design policy advisor for Denver International Airport. He decided to start a non-for-profit organization that would help promote the new airport to the people of Denver and enlisted big-name corporate and civic names to serve on the board. Ansbacher can't quite remember how he came up with the name for the organization, but he guesses it might have come from... Dvorak's New World Symphony. The New World Airport Commission name emphasized that DIA was the newest airport in the world, and the first new airport built in this country since Dallas-Fort Worth in 1973, he says. It did not symbolize that DIA was a monument to the New World Order. He says, the idea that there is anything secretive about this is totally preposterous. While Charles Ansbacher served as the cultural ambassador for Denver International Airport, the member of the New World Airport Commission that really got the heavy lifting done is a woman by the name of Ginger Evans. She was DIA's organizational muscle and was the chief of the new airport construction and associate director of aviation for the city and county of Denver during the new airport's construction. As key members of the New World Airport Commission, Charles Ambacher and Ginger Evans may fall short of the all-powerful overlords we normally want to associate with shadow governments in our big mega conspiracies. But that does not mean that they did not wield a certain amount of control and influence. Beyond the planning and construction of the airport, the work of Ambacher and Evans helped to give Denver International the very strange and real identity it has to this day. On our final episode on Denver International Airport, let's crack open that time capsule buried by the New World Airport Commission and see what Ambacher and Evans left there for us. Thank you for listening to the Whatever Remains podcast. I'm your host, Marie Mayhew. On our next episode, we'll talk with Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami, Joseph Uzinski. He studies public opinion and mass media with a focus on conspiracy theories and why people believe in them, and is the co-author of the book American Conspiracy Theories, a great read and one of our sources for this episode. After that, we'll close the series with the real reasons that DIA was billions of dollars short and years late in its opening. And strangely enough, it does have to do with that shadow group, the New World Airport Commission. So, until then, safe travels, and remember, keep listening, won't you? Want to know what Whatever Remains is getting up to next? Follow us on Twitter at Whatever Remains or online at whateverremainspodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to the show and give us your 5-star reviews on iTunes, unless you are my mom, who somehow only gave me 3 stars. Seriously, your reviews help others to find the show, and we love, love, love hearing from our listeners, so please reach out. Our music is by Group Rhoda. The all-seeing eye, or our logo, is by the super talented Desdemona, who now is in her own phenomenal podcast called Darkness Calls. Check them out. Voice talent for this episode: Theron LaFontaine, Brian Sheard, June Jung, Terrence Jenkins, Jim G. Johnson, and Fernando Godinez. Copyright 5 Orange Pips Productions, all rights reserved.